Hey, everybody. This is Brandon with The Blueprint, one of my favorite people I've ever met in my life today. I'm so excited about this interview. Super genuine, has done so many things. I can't wait for her to tell her story. Colleen Hoover, New York Times bestseller times, I think, 175,000 right now. So at the end of the day, like, I can't wait for you to hear what she's got and everything that she has inside for us. So, Colleen, how are you?
I'm great. What an intro, man.
Well, thank you so much for coming on with us. You know, today is really about just kind of talking to people and telling them your story and where you came from. So really, I think to start off, I would like to just say thank you so much for being so transparent with everybody out there. I follow you on social media, and I think that's how we even kind of met to begin with.
Yeah.
But follow you on social media, and it's been really cool to see the connection that you have with so many people out there. It's actually even made it to where I think about that when I go to do my own social media.
Right.
You know, instead of just trying to drop a message on people or whatever, some things you've done and seen, and you sometimes even kind of make fun of yourself just to,
I'm very self-deprecating. It's fun.
Well, cool. Tell me your story. Tell me where you started.
Oh God, where do you want me to start from? I feel like I've lived a million lives. I'm from East Texas, Northeast Texas, grew up, born and raised in Hopkins County. Met the love of my life when I was 16. We got married. Well, we didn't get married at 16, but, we waited. but I went to school and we started having kids when I was in college. And I thought that I was going to major in social work. I mean, journalism, but ended up majoring in social work because it ended up being a faster track. And I was like, journalism is not going to feed my kids. Where am I going to get a job around here? I need something, where I could put food on the table. So I majored in social work and did that throughout my 20s. And then when I was 31, I got bored. I got bored. My kids were, young, busy with their lives. My husband was a truck driver over the road. And I started writing this story that turned into a book. And man, did it kind of go crazy from there.
Yeah. I remember when you first talked to me about it, you said that you had a family member that was trying to hear some of your older stories. And
yeah, so what it was is I finished this story. I wrote this story about an 18-year-old girl. They consider it young adult. And I had been telling my family about it because I didn't know anything about publishing. I didn't even look at it like it was a book. I kept telling people, I wrote a story. Do you want to read it? Mm-hmm. And my grandmother wanted to read it.
Yeah.
And she had just gotten a Kindle for Christmas. And this was back in Christmas of 2011. And so I Googled, how can I get, this Word file onto a Kindle? And that's when I found that you could upload books to Amazon, self-publishing. And so that's what I did. I self-published this book New Year's Day, 2012, just so that people in my family could read it on their Kindles. It was all the rage for everyone to get a Kindle that year.
Yeah.
And by May of that year, that book had hit the New York Times as a self-published book. I didn't have an agent. I didn't have an editor. I didn't have a publishing house. I had no idea what I was doing. It was just simply word of mouth. Uh-huh. And people started buying it, and it ended up, debuting at like number 13. I thought I was being punked when I got the phone call that it was going to be on the New York Times. I mean, I was still working full-time as a social worker, so it's crazy.
So you just put something out as a family member asked, I always describe our stories as like water going down a hill, and sometimes it comes across a stone, which changes our path, right?
Right.
Sometimes someone asks something of us or we do something for someone and it changes our path forever.
Right.
And that seems very similar to what you said. So I've always been super impressed with that. That's truly the definition of nothing to something,
Right. Yeah. Oh, yeah. We were, I was very happy. My husband and I were very happy. We were happy, with our kids, and we thought life was great, although we were broke as, I don't know if I can cuss on here, broke as heck.
And say what you want.
Lived in a single wide trailer. We didn't have a front doorknob because it was like $12. We had to shove a washcloth where the front doorknob was, I remember. And when people started downloading the book, I got, I don't know, like maybe 30 cents a copy when someone would buy it back then. And I remember telling my husband, like, I was like, oh my gosh, I think we're going to be able to pay our water bill with this. And we were stoked. Like, I can't even tell you what little expectations I had for like this book and this career, and then to see what it's turned into. Like, I feel like every day I still wake up in shock.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You know, and so from the time that you first released this, and then you said, maybe we'll be able to pay a bill or two with this, right?
Yeah.
When did you start thinking, you know, like, maybe I need to start getting my act together and thinking about the other roles that might go with this?
It took me a bit. You know, when it hit the New York Times, then I got started getting calls from agents and publishers. And that's when I was like, what if I can make a career of this? The problem was, I loved my job. I loved the women I worked with. I had been there 4 years. I had a college degree in social work and actually wasn't even using my degree at that point, because I started this job when I was in between jobs. I was making $9 an hour with a college degree and just couldn't quit because I loved those girls so much. So it was very hard to make that choice. But then my boss, Stephanie, she was like, you know what? Do it. And if it doesn't work out, come back to work here. You know, you have to chase this. You have to see if you can make a career out of this, because, you know, I've always wanted to be a writer. I just never gave myself enough credit. I kind of, you know, had a fear was holding me back, imposter syndrome, having 3 kids, you know, so I really credit it all to the ladies I worked with.
Mm-hmm. We always talk about the support system is everything, right? Mm-hmm. I credit my wife with being able to do the things that I get to do. And I mean, no matter what, she's always saying like, you can do this, or I love that, or I'm proud of you, or those things like that. And it's, you know, it sounds so super small, but when you're making decisions for your family, when you're making decisions on the direction of where you're going, and that means everything to have your partner on the other side say, I got you. You know, and you said, you know, the love of your life earlier, like, what's his reaction been throughout this at this point?
Oh my God, don't even get me talking about this. I'm going to cry. He's my best friend. He's my biggest supporter. He doesn't read my books, and I love that, you know, but he is so proud of me. He's just full of pride. We went and watched the movie that's coming out in August. We got to see an early copy, and he cried through the whole thing. You know, And it probably wasn't the subject matter. He's just like, yeah, I could do nothing without him. Nothing. Like, he makes my life so much easier. I haven't had to do laundry or dishes in 13 years. Like, you know, he became a stay-at-home dad once the writing career started working out. Yeah.
Yeah, I've met him a few times. Super genuine guy. You can really see the bond that you guys have together, but just the way he looks at you is pretty cool too, right? I mean, it's pretty amazing.
24 years this past Saturday.
Yeah, that's amazing. So you started this first book, and then you start to ramp this up, and you think, all right, next step is people are calling. Mm-hmm. I've got to start to make some decisions. You chose somebody, or you waited that part out, or you at this point are thinking like,
yeah, this is interesting how I went about it, because I never got into it thinking, oh, I want to see my books on the shelf. I want to be with this publisher, or this publisher. So when I finally signed with an agent and I started getting offers, they were terrifying to me, because I wrote my first 2 books, actually, right when I finished the first, I wrote the second. And then I was working on a third, and I had done it all by myself. You know, I didn't use a publisher for anything. And so when I started getting offers from publishers, it kind of terrified me. I was like, I don't really want a boss. I don't want deadlines. Like, I was afraid that if I had any of that I wouldn't work well under pressure. So I actually got a really good 7-figure offer from Macmillan, I believe it was, for 4 books. They wanted the 2 that I'd already written and then 2 future books. And I turned it down because I was like, oh my God, this is life changing. But what if I can't write those books and then I'm going to owe someone money?
Right.
I didn't want to put ourselves in debt for art that I didn't know if I still had in me. Mm-hmm. And so I ended up getting an offer from Atria Books for just the 2 I had already written that were already out there. And I was like, okay, that's not too risky. You know, like, I'm taking it away from self-publishing, and I don't know if a lot of people know about the difference, but you do get less of a royalty when you give it to a publisher, but they can also get it in the hands everywhere. Of more people. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there were positives and negatives to both decisions. And so I did that, signed with them, was really appreciative of them. But then when I finished my third book, you know, they wanted that one too, made an offer on it. And I was like, I don't know. I really enjoyed doing it myself. I kind of want to do it myself again. And so I turned them down and self-published my third one again. And that one ended up becoming the first self-published fiction novel to hit the New York Times at number one.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
That's crazy. And so, you know, a lot of people are thinking like, how do I do this? How do I get something out there? Because I need to be able to find other people to draft onto or to pick those roles up. But you're saying like, I just wanted to do it by myself because, you know, especially as an artist, like I've done gallery shows and things like that. And it's like, I give half of my stuff to every gallery that I show with, right?
Right.
And as you're trying to make business work, it's difficult. You took the approach of, I'm doing this by myself.
Yeah, I think it helped that I went into it without goals. And you have dreams. I think dreams and goals are a little bit different. Like I had dreams of finishing a book, of, you know, having it published and all of these things. But then when it starts becoming a reality, like it was very hard to stay centered and be like, what's more important to me? Is it the money? Is it the ability to tell people, you know, like Simon & Schuster's my publisher? Like none of those were ever the reason I started out. And so I kept trying to remind myself, like, that's not why I'm in this. I'm in this because I enjoy writing. I enjoy connecting with my readers. And at that time, it was very different. Like publishers, you know, social media was so new that then like you kept your distance from readers if you were with traditional publishing. And there were just so many different things between self-publishing and traditional publishing. Self-publishing had such a horrible stigma. It still does. Mm-hmm. You know, people think, well, if you self-publish, that means you're not good enough to get a publisher.
Right.
Luckily, that has changed completely. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it was really hard. It was hard, you know, especially when they're dangling these carrots in front of you. I just also know myself really well. And I know that happiness means the most to me. And I was like, what is going to make me happy? And that is writing when I want to write, not having a deadline, not having a boss telling me that what I wrote is good for them or not. And the money was never on the table as the important thing. And like I said, it was because we were poor, but we were happy, you know? Like, it was never like, oh, we would be so much happier if we had this. Like, we had goals. I had a degree. We were working toward that in other ways. But I never used the writing as, you know, I never used money as motivation for writing. And I think because of that, I ended up making a lot of decisions that benefited me a lot more than if I would have done it the other way.
Mm-hmm. And so as you start to write these books and you get into a theme, right? So for those of you, you've got a ton of followers or people out there that know who you are. But for those that don't, like, how would you describe your books?
I'm the worst at describing my books. I will say that they're all pretty different from each other. Like I have some that are YA and teen friendly because I was in the mood to write that. And then I would get in the mood to write something, you know, really heartbreaking and sad for adults. And then I would want to write a thriller where I get to murder lots of people. I have a paranormal ghost story. That is another reason I had a conversation with a really prominent editor from a publishing house that was always my dream publishing house. And I remember she told me they wanted to brand me and wanted me to write women's fiction and only women's fiction, because at that time It Ends With Us had come out and had done well. And that's what they wanted from me from now on. And I was like, that's when I checked out. I was like, this is not right for me. If I have someone telling me what type of book that I have to write,
right,
I don't want to write.
Right.
And that's helped me. Like I'm not known for one book or one, you know, age range or anything. Like I feel like I write what I want to read. And sometimes that's different And I think that's the best thing I did for my career was not know the rules, not listen to anyone's rules that they were trying to tell me, and just do what my heart wanted to do. And yeah, it was such a great choice, and it's made me enjoy the career more, I think.
I think, you know, that's a common thread that I see so much through artists in general, right? Ones that are super passionate about what they do, the only thing they'll accept is open canvas, right? You give me parameters and I have a hard time bouncing, because really the creativity is kind of wandering, you know, and then trying to find out where it's supposed to go. And really the journey's within, you know, as you are writing, you don't really know where this is going, and you're following it, you know? I feel the same way with my stuff. And that's the reason I'm connecting with what you're saying, is like, I feel that, like, and that's one of the requirements that I throw out, is like, blank canvas.
Yeah.
No rules.
Right? I do think it's easy to say for me. And so sometimes I feel a bit hypocritical, because things have gone well for me in my career. And sometimes I feel like I haven't paid my dues. And so I feel kind of bad telling people, oh, just, you know, write what you want to write. Because if they're wanting to make a career of this, maybe there is a formula they should be following. Maybe there is a certain type of genre they should be writing. I always do question when I give that advice, because I don't want to lead people the wrong way, because I do feel like things, I don't know, everything just kind of lined up and I didn't have to struggle a whole lot for the direction my career went in. But at the same time, it may be just because I truly, and it's easy for me to say right now, but I truly, truly believe I would have never been jaded by this career had I not made money. I would have enjoyed the writing as much as I've enjoyed it, getting paid for it.
Right.
Because I got into it without caring about the money. So I think it really just depends on your intentions with your art.
But I think that at the same point too, that what you're calling out is not everybody's path is the same.
Right.
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 I'm going to give you tidbits. I'm going to give you some things that have happened, maybe some tips that you may want to look into, but we're not the same. And that's generally what makes things special.
Yeah.
Right. When you create something and it's from you and it's from passion in your heart and your mind, that's what makes it special. When somebody else creates something, if they try to go by an equation, doesn't really have that specialness to it. Right. And so,
well, and that's when you get jaded, I believe, is when you look at someone else's path and you try to model that or mirror it, and it doesn't happen for you the way that it happened for them. You start to question, why isn't this happening for me? You know, I'm doing everything they're doing. And then you start to hate what you do.
Yeah. Yeah, that is a tough one to do. I mean, I think that there's a lot of people out there really trying to chase so hard that you can take a passion and turn it into an anger moment, you know? And that's a tough thing. But at the end of the day, everyone's their own individual. You know, we can all kind of chase our own dreams. And I think that's kind of the crux of what we're getting at, is stay true to who you are. Stay true to what you're doing as you start to write these, or tell your story or whatever it is in your life, and stay connected to the magic.
Yeah.
You stay connected to the magic, and that's what people want to see, you know?
Yeah. I mean, I truly think people can feel it too, because there have been books that I've written that I didn't fully connect with, but I was on deadline and had employees to pay. And I could always tell which books would resonate more with readers before I released them, because they resonated more with me.
Yeah.
And that's why I've slowed down. I haven't written in quite a while, because I'm like, I'm not putting something out there just because I know right now I have the largest audience I've ever had and it's going to sell. I haven't written in 2 years. I just started writing my next book because I want myself to be happy with it. I really don't care. I mean, of course, it would be great if readers liked it, but that's never been what brings me joy.
The cool thing to me is how we met. I think you reached out to me on social media and said, hey, I'm an author. I'm interested in getting some illustrations done for one of my books. And from my perspective, I'm sure you get this all the time too, but from my perspective, when people reach out to you on social media, you got to vent through the crap.
Yeah.
Right? There's so much stuff that comes over that's just just bull, you know? And so,
yeah, I go, hey, can you do this for, you know, nothing at all? And I need it by tomorrow. And
100%, right? And so you go into the vetting process of who is this person, right? And so I started looking you up and I'm like, oh, she's a legitimate writer. Like, okay, cool. Like, where are you? Then I looked you up from that point and I was like, you're like 40 minutes away from where I'm living. Like,
yeah, that's crazy.
How cool was this, you know? And so I called you back and you were like, hey, I've got this idea. The book was Without Merit. Mm-hmm. You said to me, Brennan, I love your art style. I want to bring you into this and I think it's cool. I want you to play the role of an artist, but I want you to play the role of an artist in high school.
Yeah, exactly. A kid artist.
Which was cool to me. I've never played like I can see as an actor, you got to step in other roles, but as an artist, you're always trying to produce like your very best thing.
I didn't want to insult you, but I was like, you're a little too good for what I'm looking for. Can you
back it up?
Back it up a little. Yeah, but even like the art you gave me was so good. It was so good.
Well, I had so much fun doing that. And let me tell you why. I've never had anybody give me like a concept. Mm-hmm. Right?
Yeah.
And say, because you looked at me and said, I want somebody, you know, drowning and trying to survive, trying to take themselves out, and they're even failing at that, right?
Yeah.
And so as we start, you know, kicking across ideas of things we can do, like the cinder block's floating on top of the water and she's got a rope and she's sitting on the bottom, right?
Yeah.
She can't even, you know, succeed at that part of it. And the cool thing is that you know, I went through all those concepts with you and it was really nice to kind of bounce those across. I said, I've had a really good time, you know, illustrating for you as that person in that position. So thank you very much for that. But I'm going to see if I can get you to send me some more concepts at some point, just so I can illustrate them one time.
Oh, I'd love to. Yeah, that's so much fun. I actually was just talking to Heath on the way here. I was like showing him the stuff you've been doing recently with the purses. I know I really want one. I can't say for who on here in case they listen. But yeah, I like how you, you know, you branch out with more than just a painting in a frame. Like I remember two of the ones I bought from you were the Doors painting on a door and the Amy Winehouse painting on wine corks.
Yep,
like it's just so creative that it's more than just a canvas.
Mm-hmm.
You make everything your canvas.
Well, even like DJ3 here with the McDonald's wrappers around the outside of those are all McDonald's bags.
That's
and receipts
amazing.
And Happy Meals and everything inside of that. So to me, it's kind of fun to use things of in real life to kind of pin those in and tell the story behind it. You know, it's just and it gives people things to look at over time. Like, if I paint a pretty picture and you put it in front of somebody and they look at it and say, oh, I like red or I like blue or whatever. To me, I want a little deeper conversation.
Mm-hmm.
What are you getting out of that? Yeah, or they go, oh, did you see that? Or blah, 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 right?
Like if someone buys a painting of yours that means so much to you, but they're buying it because it matches their couch.
Mm-hmm.
Like, does that hurt a little bit?
It does, actually. you know, it's funny. Like as I've gone in and sat at shows of mine before, some people know I'm the artist and some don't, right?
Yeah.
I've even had somebody where I went up one time and this guy's like telling me all about the artist. He knows my whole life. He knows the story of it. He knows which ones I painted in what order. He knows all that stuff. And he doesn't know my face. And I'm sitting right next to him asking him about this painting. And he's telling me what I think about it and everything else, right? That's cool, you know, to kind of see that kind of stuff. But it was funny to me at the time, right? And then, you know, there's also the ones where, you know, you sit there and you go put something out in front of somebody that's a story that really hits home. You know, like I had a story one time of, I don't know if you saw the ones that I had, the portraits of the neon across their face.
Mm-hmm.
It was, I went to Miami one time and there was a guy that came into a show that I was at and he's dressed to the nines, pulls up in a Lambo, he's dressed to the nines, you know, he's got, you know, everything going for him or whatever. And I'm like, okay, this guy's doing well for himself. Well, this beautiful woman steps out of the car, right? And I mean, model-esque. And I'm sitting here thinking, man, this woman has the world by the tail because she's beautiful. She's got gifts and jewelry and looks and everybody's, you know, waiting on her, you know, hand and foot, you know? And it's like, well, good for her, you know? Well, this guy comes in. He's like, big time at me or whatever. He's like, oh, I'm just going to buy all these. Don't worry about it. And blah, blah, blah. And I was like, yeah, there's a story I'm telling with these. You don't want to hear my story? Like, and he's like, I'll just get them on this one and that one. And I was like, man, it's not really connecting the way that I want you to connect. Like, hear my words, you know? And I remember that woman that walked in with him told him, she said, hey, I'm going to go smoke a cigarette outside, right? And so he walks back, she walks back outside and leans on the side of the front fender of his car in a mini skirt smoking a cigarette, right? And he looked at me and said, excuse me, I'll be right back. Walks outside and he says, what the F did I tell you? Don't you ever lean against my car again, ever, ever. As a matter of fact, I'm done. This should have been gone a long time ago. You're not worried. And so goes to the front, opens the hood, which the hood is where the trunk is in the Lambo, right? Takes all of her clothes and like opens her bag, right? Throwing bras and panties and clothes, stringing them out on the deal, right? And so now I'm walking outside, you know, and a crowd starts to gather around. In Texas, you know, you start doing that to a female, we're going to stand up and say like, yo, chill out or whatever.
Yeah.
So we all start
not gonna fly.
No, we all start walking outside, right? Because I see stuff doing that, you know? And as soon as we start coming outside, he goes around and gets in the front of the car and tells her, find your own way home. I'm not flying you back on my jet, blah, 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 right? And then he turns to us and goes, sorry, gentlemen, sorry y'all had to see this, but it had to happen.
Sorry y'all had to see this.
Then he shuts the door and drives off. And I turn and I look this woman in her eyes. And she's broken, completely destroyed, crying, embarrassed. And she's looking at me and I'm looking at her. There's 20 other people around us. But what she was just presented to a minute ago was like this beautiful woman that had the world by the tail. And at that moment, it had absolutely hit me that I'd misjudged this person, this human, that I thought you have a gift because of this. But really, what you had was a curse.
Yeah.
Because people looked at you as if you were a trophy.
Right.
You weren't real.
Right.
You know, you didn't have the other things in life that were worthy of conversation or love or patience or things like that, right?
Yeah.
You didn't have that. And so everybody was just treating you for what they could use you for and move on, you know? And so I had to go home and paint this woman. I painted her three different times. And I painted a picture, a portrait of a beautiful woman, and in neon over her face, I put, love me, hold me, kiss me. The things that are like true to a relationship, the things that you should offer to somebody.
Yeah.
And I wanted you to see that first before you saw all the other stuff, because it just hit me so hard of like, I just completely went about this backwards, you know? And then I had to paint that guy afterwards, which was like, which was like this guy that was like, came in as a king. And then you ripped away the piece of the painting and he's a jester underneath, right?
Right.
It's a jackass, you know?
Yeah.
But it took me so many times to paint that, to get that out of my heart. You know, you're a sponge sometimes for the people around you,
mm-hmm.
you know, and the experiences you see in life. And sometimes you have to paint them or write them to get those out.
Yeah.
You know?
Absolutely.
And I know that you wrote one of your books basically about that.
Yeah. Yeah. It Ends With Us is based on, very loosely, I would say inspired by my mother and my father's relationship. And she's just this amazing, strong, independent, she's my hero, you mm-hmm. know? And I knew that when she was married to my dad, it was a very abusive relationship. And I was so young, you know, I have maybe one or two memories of them together. And I never could understand, like, why'd you stay with him so long? Why did you have two kids with him? Like, what the heck? That's not you, you know? And I actually wrote that book to kind of get in her head and put myself in her shoes. And man, did it make me understand her and women who have been, you know, in those situations. It's not that you're married to a monster and that's the problem. My dad was a great dad. My dad was a charismatic human being. He was just a shit husband.
Mm-hmm.
And she's the only one that got that side of him. But she loved him most of the time, you know. Mm-hmm. Loved him all the time. He was hurt by him a lot. But, you know, you fall in love with someone who then every now and then becomes a monster. It's not as hard to just walk away from that. Like they, you know, I think they portray abuse in these people to be just 100% monsters all the time. And I really, really understood now how hard it is. And so I wrote that book hoping it would help people give these women or be less judgmental toward women that have been through that and understand them more on why they stayed as long as they did, but then also wrote the book hoping to show them that you can leave. You can get out of that. You will have a support system on the other side, hopefully. Yeah, so a lot of that is made up. Obviously, it's fiction. But the actual scene where the woman gets hit by the man she loves for the first time was exactly what happened between my mother and father.
And how hard was it to write that?
So hard. Oh my gosh. Yeah, because even in the book, like, it was hard because I was really liking the guy character that was eventually, you know, going to do these things. And so it was very hard. And I kept wanting to, like, take the book in a different direction. And I was like, no, this is what I'm doing. And also very hard to send that to her, mm-hmm. you know, and have her read it. But I wanted her to, you know, let me know if I was getting it right.
Did you tell her about beforehand that this was about her?
Oh, yeah. I asked her permission. Okay. I would have never done that if she wasn't okay with it. And my dad passed away a long time ago when I was 25. But honestly, my mom never talked about the abuse. Like, I don't think I would have known about it if it weren't for my dad. Like, mm-hmm. he was very open with us about it. And because, you know, he was an alcoholic when he was younger. He dealt with a lot of demons. And as he aged, he realized a lot of his mistakes. Mm-hmm. I don't know that he changed because I don't know that anyone ever really gave him a chance to fall in love again. And he, you know, constantly just regretted the decisions he made early on in his life. But mm-hmm. Yeah, I was the first to be like, yeah, I was a terrible husband.
Yeah, and a lot of times when you get next to someone who is toxic like that, you know, mm-hmm. they don't always let that toxicity come to the surface at the beginning.
Right.
And so you build enough time and rapport with this person until it leaks out a little bit in certain areas. But the more time goes by, the less you feel like that's a consistent trait. You really feel like it's something else, right? And so it leaks out more and more over time until it gets to the final threshold. You're like, man, I've been in this for 15 years and now I'm got two kids and I'm stuck and whatever, right?
Yeah.
And
so, no money, no career. Like, how do you leave at that point? And I do think in the book, you know, I made it a little easy on the character because she was able to leave easier than my mother was. Back then, there were no resources. She didn't have a degree to fall back on. Mm-hmm. So now I look at it and I'm like, my God, how did you leave? Mm-hmm. It's no longer like, why did you stay so long? It's like, how did you get yourself out of that? Mm-hmm. She said there was a whole year where we ate like beans and Kraft macaroni and cheese for dinner.
Mm-hmm. For that's a good year, though. Yeah. Those are so good.
It really is.
You still eat some mac and cheese though.
Heck yeah. I prefer that too, the Kraft macaroni and cheese.
So at this point, do you think that caused a career decision for you?
In what way?
Like your first job. You know, when you got into, you know, the Children's Advocacy Center mm-hmm. and things like that, do you think seeing some of that action in your own life?
You know, I don't know because I look back at my childhood, like I lived a very normal life. She met my stepdad when I was 4. Mm-hmm. And so that's the childhood I remember, growing up on a dairy farm, having all my cousins around, playing in the pasture, milking cows. Like I had a great childhood. With a very loving mom and stepdad. And so, yeah, I had, you know, the earliest memory I have, I was probably 2 and can remember my father throwing a TV at my mother. Mm-hmm. And, but that's not something that like, you know, I thought about regularly or carried mm-hmm. with me. And so I don't think that that's why I chose the career that I went into. I've always enjoyed helping people and, My mother actually, this is a fun story. When I was in high school, I was filling out the FAFSA for college, you know, because we were broke and I needed their income information. So she gave me their tax forms. And I remember my senior year in high school, they made $13,000 on that dairy farm. And I was like, well, first of all, how are we eating? Like, you know, but when I was filling that out, she was, I think, 40. I was 18. And she was like, so they're just going to pay for your college, like the government? And I was like, well, yeah, you made $13,000 as a couple, you know, like I'll probably get some grants. And she was like, do you think I could go to college? And I was like, yeah. So I ended up filling out the FAFSA for her. And we both started college at the same time. And she graduated 3 years later, took me six with a 4.0, worked full time. And then she's the first one that went into social work. And when she, because she was a little bit ahead of me, she's really the reason why I went into it, because she was telling me how much she enjoyed the degree. Like, I changed my degree. It took me 6 years because I had like seven different majors.
Yeah.
And probably 20 jobs throughout college.
So what were those majors that you were picking on early?
I started out my first semester in journalism because that's always been my dream. I wanted to write. I wanted to do that. I got pregnant and I'm like, how am I going to be a journalist? I'm going to be a mom now. So then I decided to change to nursing. I remember I changed to technical writing for a while. I did, I actually have a degree in infant nutrition. I'm a little all over the place. I was a teacher for a year. I have three kids and they're all grown adults now. My oldest is 23, but they have not figured out life yet. And I'm like, you know what? Good. Because your 20s are for fucking up. Because by your 30s, you'll know exactly what you hate and exactly what you love. And I have no regrets. Like my 20s, I had so many jobs, so many different majors in college. I was just trying to find, I think, what made me happy. And none of it was really making me happy. Until I sat down to write that book at 31 and, you know, not knowing it was going to be a career. But I ended up being very happy in the job I had because I was fulfilling my passion outside of that job. And I think even if that were the case now, I'd be okay with that. But, yeah.
So when you get into your kids, the same way, like, I think about my oldest graduates in a week, right? which is crazy to think about, right?
Crazy.
And my whole, everything changes when you become a parent anyways. Mm-hmm. Like, you can't tell anyone what it's going to be like if they've never experienced that, no matter what words you choose.
You can't even, you don't even have the same experience from one kid to the next with the same two parents. It's insane, yeah.
And so, I've always tried to, you know, I changed dramatically as a human being the moment I looked into my son's eyes. You could never explain that to me. You could never told me that was happening, but it was like a page had turned and I was a completely different human being.
Yeah.
And so from that moment on, I was like, I am in charge of helping this person become the best version of themselves, no matter what, and get them to where they need to be, yeah. Right? As I've gotten older, it's gotten to the point where I'm looking at a clock. I've only got this much time with them in my house to be able to instill everything that I need to instill inside of them. We say, I love you like 100 times a day, like someone will walk to get a chocolate milk and they're like, hey, I love you, love you, love you, love you, love you. And I'm sure if somebody else was sitting in our house, it would sound super annoying. But that's the way we do it. I mean, it's just whatever. It's like, but, you know, now that he's getting to the age to where he graduates this week, right? I've always thought like, I have this much time to get them prepared. And now I'm like, you can still hang out a little bit longer if you want to hang because you're my people and, you know.
Yeah. That's been so tough for me because all of mine, you know, they're several years apart, but because of the pandemic and how everything worked out, they all kind of left at the same time. I didn't get to do one at a time. And so it was a rough year last year. They're my best friends. Like you said, like, you know, them boys leave a room and they'll give me a hug before they go leave the room. Like we're just very, very close. And so this year's been an adjustment because mine are out of the house, but I've noticed like, I don't know, it's changed, but it hasn't changed. You know, they come home and it feels the same. You know, I got home from the airport pretty late last night. It was like 11 o'clock and my son, he lives a few miles from me, my youngest. And he was like, are you home yet? I miss you. I want to come give you a hug. And he came over at 11 o'clock at night just to see me because he hadn't seen me. It's been 5 days, you know? So, we could talk about our careers all day. Don't get me started on motherhood.
So, how many books do you have currently?
I don't know. 25, I think.
My wife could tell me for sure.
It's weird because at one point some of them were like split up into three novellas and now it's one book and And so it's changed a little bit as they've changed publishing hands, but I'm pretty sure it's 25.
Yep. And I remember like when you first contacted me and my wife had never heard of you either, right? And so as when we came up there, you gave me a copy of a book. And it wasn't even the book that we were working on together. It was another book. And I said, my wife loves to read. You were like, do you love to read? And I was like, I draw. You know? I was like, but my wife likes to read. And so I gave her a book. She has every book you've ever written. I mean, I'm serious. Like,
make her quit paying for them. I will send them to you.
No way. We're fam support. So at the end of the day, like, she also like has put a bunch of her friends onto you and everything. But that's what I see with people that are engaged in you as an artist, as you as a writer. People are not just fans; they're super fans of you. Like, and they were to the nail. Like, they're in your corner. What do you think has caused some of that that people to resonate with you like that?
You know, I honest to God have no idea. I get this question a lot because I actually had an author try to pay me to tell her what I'm doing at one of my signings. And I was like, what are you talking about? She was just like, I want your following. I want to sell the books you sell. What marketing company are you using? Like, what are you doing? And she was like trying to hand me a wad of money because she thinks I'm keeping this huge secret from people. I don't know. I think what it is it's a combination of a lot of things. But what I attribute it to is in the very beginning when social media started, I wasn't a writer. I was a mom and someone who enjoyed social media and who enjoyed talking to people on social media. And so as I started writing, I treated social media the same way as I always did. You know, I was just very open and shared my life and I slowly built a following. Like, you know, back in 2012 when Slammed released and hit the New York Times, no one knew who I was. It hit the New York Times as an ebook. You couldn't find me in a bookstore for years. But I had my core readers and they supported me the whole way. So every book that I wrote, just I'd get a few more readers and a few more readers. I never spent money on marketing, never took out ads. You know, Amazon started charging a crap load of money to people. And it makes me so sad knowing that there's some authors out there spending $20,000 a month on marketing because they think that's what I and other people are doing. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not that case. Like, you can find, hopefully, an audience with longevity. I mean, this didn't happen overnight for me. Like, I didn't really blow up until the pandemic. I'd already been writing for a decade. So yeah, I think it's patience. I think that people by their third or fourth book, if nothing's happened and it's still costing them more to write and publish the book than it is, you know, than they're making, then you give up. And I'm like, I've seen people in this industry not even sell until their 30th book, you know? But that's also, I think, where people go wrong is when they try to turn this into a career. Like, we go back to the you get jaded because it's very rare, I think, that artists can make a living off of their art.
Right.
Especially writers. Like, I feel like the median or the average income for a writer is like 10 grand a year for novelists.
Right.
No one can live on that.
Right. 100%. Yeah. You know, I think that, you know, even going back to some of the things that you and I kind of worked on, I remember because in your bookstore, like, I'd met you, I came down there and you had this new bookstore that you'd had open and it was The Bookworm. And the purpose of that was, tell a little bit about that.
Yeah, so The Bookworm Box was a charity we started, me and my sisters, and we would send out signed books from different authors in these boxes every month, and we were doing it out of our living room. The first month we announced it, we capped it at however many books we had to send out because we had asked authors to send us some signed books. We were able to raise, I think, $12,000 that month and donated that to charity. The next month was $15,000, donated that to charity. And then we realized, like, we can't keep doing this in our living room. It's getting bigger. And so we ended up buying renting a space downtown in Sulphur Springs, very cute downtown area. And we had, you know, a storefront, but once a month is when we would like push all the books aside and build our assembly line and ship the thousands of boxes out every month. Yeah. But yeah, that ended up being a way bigger deal than we ever thought it would be. Mm-hmm. I think we closed the bookstore recently just because I have no time now. Like, I feel like I have 5 full-time jobs and I'm mm-hmm. having to like pick and choose like what to move forward with. But I think we ended up donating $2 million in the 8 years it's been open.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
That's crazy. You know, and I remember walking in there and you were like, you had all these blank walls. Mm-hmm. And you were like, if you want to put some art in here, I'll be happy to, you know, share with you. Because people travel from all over.
All over. It was insane. It was kind of like a specialty bookstore that we didn't realize how special it would be to a lot of readers. But, mm-hmm. you know, every book in the store was signed by the author. We had people from Australia and France and Canada and constantly. It was insane. Mm-hmm. Insane. You know, if they were going to be in Texas, they would drive to Sulphur Springs to go visit the store.
Yeah. That's really cool. And then I remember putting, I don't know, what did I have, 8 or 10 pieces in there for a while? I mean, for a long time.
Yeah.
I drove down there one weekend and just hung pieces and put them in there. And then I left them there.
Yeah.
And then I just remember, like you said, hey, we're closing the bookstore. And I was like, oh yeah, I've got those pieces down there, you know? And so I came back, got them. And for me, it was like a time capsule, right?
Yeah.
It was.
That's cool.
There were like 8 or 10 pieces that were captured in a time where that was me at the time, right? And so now, like, you know, over 10 years' time, you get better at your craft. And I was like, how did I ever let these out of my sight? Like, what am I doing? You know what I mean?
Oh my God, we get so many compliments on those. But I feel the same way. Like, my earlier books, oh man, I'm so mortified by the majority of my books. And it's like, every time someone's like, should I start at the beginning? I'm like, please, please don't do that.
Where would you, so this is what I was getting to. Yeah. Like, for me, like, if a painting of mine will come back or I still hold on to it, if I get better and I see it, I'll fix it. You can't fix a story. Once it's out, it's out.
I can't, yeah.
So where down the process of the line do you say, this is where I really feel like right now is me? Because I can tell you to the date of where I was, which is going to be different in 3 years anyways.
Yeah, You know, that's hard for me because there are aspects to some of the stuff I did a long time ago that I like. There are aspects to the stuff I do now that I end up hating a month later. Mm-hmm. I'm my own worst critic. I believe every negative thing I read. I let the positive stuff go in one ear and out the other. I could sit here and say, like, you know, I wish I didn't do that. But I think as artists, it's just, you know, it's just how we focus because mm-hmm. I also, you know, used to look at the criticism all the time and learned a lot from it. Mm-hmm. But I would say probably my last 3 or 4 books are the ones that I always recommend to new mm-hmm. readers because I don't want them to go to the earlier ones.
Okay. So speaking of that, so even going into when you and I did that book, mm-hmm. you did an autograph signing in Highland Park, which is in Dallas for those that don't understand that part. But it was down in Highland Park and I forget the store that it was at, but I remember you had asked me to come down there and sign with you, right? And this is at a time where I had not done a mass signing ever.
Yeah.
Right? And so I called down there and said, I got stuck behind a wreck. I'm late. I'm 5 minutes late, but I'll be there. Like, I'd planned to be there 30 minutes early, but I just got caught. And you were like, don't worry about it. It's no big deal, whatever. So nice to me about it. Just very gracious. And I was like, I'm so sorry. I was sweating or whatever as I was coming down. I just felt terrible, you know, because I always like, your word is your word, right? And you tell somebody you're there, right?
I don't even remember you being late. That's how much it stuck with me.
Well, this is going to be the thing that you will remember. So I called you when I was in the parking lot and I said, I'm here. And you're like, cool, whatever. I looked outside and there is a line like wrapped around the building of people waiting to get an autograph from you. And I thought, oh my gosh, I've stepped into something that I don't even know what I'm involved in. And it was wild, you know? And so I walked to the front door and I opened the door and the place erupts with cheers and yells and everything else. And I'm looking around like, looking behind me to see if anybody's like, what is Elvis behind me? What's happening, right? And I look over and then like, I see you at the table and everybody's still yelling and cheering. And I was just like, maybe like this. And then all of a sudden they all stopped. And you said, I just told them to make sure that they showed up for you today. And I laughed so hard. It was so good because it was like, I was nervous walking in. And yeah. the way that you did that was really great because it diffused the situation really easily.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
I think you're really good at that, you know.
Oh, like, I appreciate that. I feel like, you know, my favorite part, I think, of all of this is the readers. Like, mm-hmm. I feel like I do have such a good relationship. It's different now because there's millions of them. And used to, you know, I had like 100,000 or 200,000 on Instagram as of 3 years ago. And mm-hmm. now there's 2 million. And mm-hmm. so it feels different. And that part makes me sad because I feel like I can't make that same connection mm-hmm. that I used to make. But man, it's so special. I get so nervous. You put a TV crew in front of me. I don't even know my name. I can't mm-hmm. talk. I don't do TV interviews. Mm-hmm. I don't do things like that. But if you just get me in a room with some readers and do a Q&A, I could mm-hmm. do that for 10 hours straight. And it would be the funnest thing in the world.
I could tell that. And as we were going down the line and everybody was really engaging with you, yeah. you took time to ask them about their day and where they came from and how the journey was and everything else, as opposed to like, thank you, thank you. Yeah. And that connection, I just watched it. It was pretty special, even to the fact of like you signed first. And then they would hand the book, you would hand the book to me to sign in there as well. Mm-hmm. And these people looked at me with such disdain, like, don't you touch my book. And I was like,
oh my gosh, no, they weren't. Are you kidding? They would have been so mad if they didn't get your signature. No, trust me, because you're not the first artist I've used. Like, that was something really fun for me in the beginning, was infusing something more into a book that mm-hmm. could help another artist. I know I had a musician do a soundtrack for one. I had a painter do some paintings for Confess. And, you know, I had poetry for Slammed. Like, it was so important to me, I think, to have just like this extra element. And anytime there was another person involved behind that, mm-hmm. the readers, like anything they could get their signature on was mm-hmm. like gold. And still to this day, like, you know, you see these books being resold or given to Half Price Books, and none of them ever with the extra signatures get given.
Right.
So don't say that about yourself, because they were so stoked for that.
Well, I mean, I don't mean it to be like to talk negative. I was just like saying, like, they were so excited about yours. It was like they were ready to get it back in their hands. And here I was sliding over to me, and they were like, just give it, just give it, just give it, just give it. You know, that was a really cool moment for me, you know, to watch that through another person's eyes who had that kind of connection with such a large audience, you know?
Yeah.
And like you say, like, I just called you out of the blue to see if you wanted to do this. And like, I follow you on social media. I don't go into your account to look how many followers you have or whatever, but I did when I asked you, because I was like, well, here's Colleen and here's some things that are about her. And I was like, holy shit, she's got 2 million followers on here. What? When did this happen?
Exactly.
You know, I mean, that's amazing. Like, I knew that you yeah. were blowing up, but, you know, insane. At the same point, like, that's a huge number. Like, is that super recent? Like,
yeah. So during the pandemic, TikTok kind of blew up, and I don't know what happened. I don't know why my books took off like they did on TikTok. I did make several of them free for a couple of weeks when the pandemic started. The ones that I still owned and that were self-published, I was thinking, oh, you know, people are off work for 2 weeks. We didn't know it was going to last as long as it did. I was mm-hmm. like, here, I dropped the price to free on these 6 books. Yeah, it gives you something to do since you can't go to work. Mm-hmm. And I remember thinking, you know, a few thousand people would download them. And the next day it was like hundreds of thousands. And so I think it was like a combination of everyone downloading TikTok, the book talk part of TikTok taking off, everyone having just read some of my books for free, they went and picked up more. I think it helped that I wasn't like a one-hit wonder or, you know, popular for one series. It was, I had 25 books. So when they finished one, they could go to another and go to another. And yeah, I remember every day just kind of when I would log on social media, I would have 10,000 more followers every day. I'd be like, what is happening? I remember my publisher called me and they were like, so we noticed your books are selling more than they usually do. Like, do you have an ad? And I was like, no, it's TikTok.
Yeah.
And they were like, what's TikTok? Oh, like, they didn't even yeah. know at the uh-huh. time what TikTok was. And yeah, so started around 2020. I would say 22 and 23 have been the craziest years.
Mm-hmm.
I can't remember if it was 22 or 23, but It Ends With Us was the best-selling book of the year. All of my books together, because what was crazy is because I had so many, people were reading them and going to the next one and going to the next one. At one point, I had 8 books on the New York Times and outsold the Bible last year.
I joked about that earlier.
Yeah.
when I said to Nick, I said, I think the only person that outsells her is the Bible. And then you literally just said, I outsold the Bible. That is bananas.
It was bananas. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. And again, well, people are still then. Like, yeah, emailing going, hey, so who's your marketing team? Who's doing this for you?
It's a smoking gun marketing agency.
Or like, which influencers did you pay to do these videos? And I'm like, uh-huh. I just want everyone to know it was organic. Uh-huh. Don't go giving people $25,000 because they tell you that I did that.
Uh-huh.
I have all these, you know, like, you've probably dealt with it too, mm-hmm. just the companies out there that are claiming that they worked with this person and this person when that's not true because they're trying to convince people that they need to give them money.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so while we have you here, don't ever give a publisher money. You should only be making money from the publisher.
That's exactly right. So as far as creativity, like what's the fastest book you've ever written and what's the longest book you've ever written? As far as time it took you to write those?
I'm almost embarrassed to say this.
Okay.
I don't think I've ever admitted this out loud, and I don't know that I want to. Let me think of how to word this. So I think about books for a long time. I make notes for a long time. So if you count like from the time you start thinking about the book to the time the book's edited, I would say never less than 6 months, mostly a year mm-hmm. is what it takes me to do a book. But Verity, I was obsessed with writing that book. It was my first thriller. I remember thinking about it, taking notes for months. And then NaNoWriMo happened. Do you know what that is?
No.
Like National November Writing Month, where you try to write a book in a month.
Mm-hmm.
And I did. I wrote Verity in a month. I had it all mapped out. But I'm still mortified that I can say that I wrote that book in 1 month because it did really well.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. And the longest?
Probably maybe Someday. I used a musician on that one and it probably took me about a year and a half to really get from start to finish. But the longest is going to be the next book that I write because I've been making notes for a couple of years, but also have been working on other stuff that's not writing. And so not actual writing has taken that long, but just to find the time to write
mm-hmm.
has been really difficult lately.
Yeah, there's been a lot of people that have challenged, like when they ask me about my stuff, how long did it take you to do that?
Yeah.
And sometimes I'll say, look, I can do a 30-foot mural by 30-foot tall by 120 wide in a weekend.
Yeah.
Right. Or I can spend 6 months on a painting. Right. And somebody will say, man, you didn't spend very long on that. Why should I pay for that? And I'm like, well, it took me 30 years of work
exactly.
to be able to get to this point, to be right. able to produce like that. Right. So I see both sides of it for somebody
yeah.
to feel like they're not justified by the amount of effort poured into it for the pain, like you said earlier, like I feel like I didn't do my dues.
Right.
Your dues are the amount of effort and passion and everything you pour into that. It doesn't have to be failures for them to be mm-hmm. dues. The dues is the amount of hours that I put in to get that out.
Well, and sometimes you're so into the art at the moment that that's you eat, sleep, breathe it. That's what I did with Verity. We're talking mm-hmm. 18 hours a day straight of
mm-hmm.
writing.
Mm-hmm.
So the amount of hours I spent on that were probably more than most of my books. It's just mm-hmm. they're spread out over different days because it's harder for me to get into the story and sit down and work. But there have been books that I've written really fast simply because they do mean more to me. I've enjoyed them more. And so it doesn't always equate to, mm-hmm. you know, a worse book just because it was quicker writing it. It may be because you were more passionate about it.
Yeah. So you have one book that I know was kind of different than the other books, right? Was it Confess?
Probably Verity. Well, Layla's paranormal. I don't usually write paranormal. Verity's thriller. The rest of them are kind of pretty much.
You had one that had some short stories in it from anecdotal. Oh,
yeah. I don't even consider that mine because that was like 20-something different authors mm-hmm. that are in it. So okay. it's more of an anthology that had a story in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so the journey from like, do you feel like you're kind of honing in on one direction? Do you like the thriller step that you've kind of taken to this point?
Absolutely. Yeah. I had the most fun, I think, writing the thriller, but it's also, to me, harder to come up with a good thriller idea. Mm-hmm. Or maybe it's because I'm scared I won't top that one. And so I've been hesitant to try. But I did enjoy writing the thriller probably the most. That one, and It Ends With Us, which mm-hmm. actually this is funny because Reminders of Him, Verity, and It Ends With Us are the three that I recommend the most depending on who I'm talking to. And I'm the proudest of those three, and those three are also my three bestsellers. Mm-hmm. And that has nothing to do with each other. Like, no one buying my books would know which ones I'm the most proud of, but that's why I know how I feel when I'm writing. The mm-hmm. readers feel it. And that's those are the books that get recommended the most mm-hmm. to their friends.
So you just hit on something, imposter syndrome.
Yeah.
Right? A lot of times people who are successful or have been successful, like, again, you've sold a lot, right? You've written a lot of books. But even to the moment of you did one that you think is a crown jewel and you're like, I'll never top that again, or I may never top that again.
Yeah.
Is it hard? Because a lot of people will feel like success was luck, not success was a craft or a gift or something they worked really hard at. Mm-hmm. They feel like it was luck. How do you get past the feeling of luck? Is it just jump back into it and let's figure it out? Or because you have to produce a lot of books throughout the year, right?
You know, I think when I describe my career, I use luck so often to say, like, I don't know, I just got lucky. I don't know why people like them. I don't know why people buy them. And I'm a self-deprecating person, but I'm also full of imposter syndrome, like still to this day. Like, I won't give people writing advice. I won't, you know, I've been invited to do podcasts and interviews and give master classes and stuff. And I'm like, why are y'all asking me? Mm-hmm. Like, I'm so still learning. And I think a lot of it too is just, I've seen how, you know, up until about 2020, I've had a very positive career, a positive relationship with social media, very kind readers. But once it was a different kind of success, it got ugly. Mm-hmm. Like, it got really ugly. People do not like successful people, apparently,
yeah.
if they don't think they deserve that success.
Right.
And most of it is from other writers
mm-hmm.
who read my books and they're like, why does this crap sell? And, mm-hmm. you know, and then I end up getting tagged in the posts and can't help but see it. And so, yeah, I don't know. I work my butt off. I do work my butt off. I put my heart into it. It may not be, you know, highbrow literary reads, but obviously people connect to it in some way. And so I'm trying to be better and kinder to myself about, you know, maybe it's not all luck. Maybe it is a little to do with good timing, but mm-hmm. maybe also you tell a story that people connect with and you need to focus on that instead of everything else. It's hard to drown out the noise sometimes.
Yeah. Well, I've always heard you made it when you got haters.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, really, when you got somebody that is so vocal that they want to tell a story or they want to tear your story down.
Yeah.
I've said this a million times. My grandfather always told me there's two ways to have the biggest building in town. You can work really hard and build yours up, or you can go smash everybody else's down, right? What kind of person are you, right? This is what he used to tell me, you know?
Exactly.
And so, but that's what people do, right? They don't have the skill set to build their own up. So they're just sledgehammers, you know?
Yeah.
Make themselves look equal. You know,
yeah.
if I'm tearing you down, now you're here with me.
Yeah.
You know? And so I've always seen, I'm thankful for haters. Thank you,
yeah.
right? Like, two things are, like, I had some guy that really just was chewing into me on one of my posts. And I'm like, dang, I really hit a nerve and I didn't mean to. I don't know what I've done. But this guy was just like, you don't know about our culture. You don't know about this. You don't know about that. And it's like, all right, cool. And then it went on. He got his buddies in and like three or four people were just harping on me. And I finally just was like, thank you so much for driving my algorithm this week.
And those, exactly.
And those,
that's what I try to focus on. I'm like, you know what? In order for you to have made the video you just made, you apparently bought my book and read it. So thank you. Yes, thank you. Yes. I appreciate the support.
Yeah. And immediately, as soon as I said that, I got no more comments from the rest of them. I was just like.
Yeah, I think honestly, that's been the hardest thing. Not the negativity. Like I'm very much like, you know, I've been doing this 13 years now and I have thick skin. You know, I don't think about it unless they're directly emailing me or I'm online and seeing it in my feed. And I'd rather not see it, but I understand that I'm going to see it. But that's one thing that's made me really have to change my relationship with social media. Like when you say, like, I have this great presence online, I feel like I've lost that because I've had to protect myself. Mm-hmm. And so while the change in success and the trajectory has been wonderful, like I also kind of feel guilt that I don't feel like I'm there for my readers like I used to be. I don't let them in as much because, mm-hmm. you know, now it's not just me people are attacking, it's my children who didn't ask for this, you know? And so it's definitely been a learning experience on how this one aspect of this career I loved so much, mm-hmm. I now have to block myself from.
Mm-hmm. And you have to protect yourself too because, you know, people become super attached.
Yeah.
You know, level 5 stalkers, you know what I mean? So,
Made a lot of people mad, you know. And I just mean like, I don't have as much time in my life, I think, to spend online and with online friends. And, and I've lost friendships over the last few years because of my, I'm not as easily accessible.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, number one, I think, is to protect your mental health or your family will suffer and there will be no more art.
Mm-hmm. You know, and I know that, you know, kind of as we've gone through this, like you've always been super kind to me. I don't know why, but we kind of started at the same time. But I mean, really like super genuine, super kind. And like, I felt like, you know, there's 1,000 other people that are, you know, maybe there's something because we live close to each other and we kind of started at the same time and, you know, really pushing it out there at the same time. And, but I'm super thankful that you've always been like, come on my podcast. I'm nobody from nowhere. You know, at the end of the day, like I'm 5 generations from Greenville, Texas, you know? So,
come on, you're not nobody to me. I feel like when I have a podcast, you'll be one of my first guests someday.
Oh, that'd be amazing.
You're extremely talented and, and I recognized your talent before I even knew where you were from. So the fact that we are pretty local has nothing to do with what I think of your art.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate that. Next step. You've done books. You've now kind of started coasting into a different avenue.
Yeah.
What's that been like?
Interesting. Very different than I thought it would be. You know, I just got back from LA last night. I've been on the Sony lot all week preparing for the trailer release for the movie that's coming out. I don't know what to expect. It's a whole different experience, but it's been really, really fun. Also really, really eye-opening. I think that I never realized how much went into making a movie, and I have a whole new respect for actors. Oh my God. Acting is one of the hardest jobs in the world. It is unreal. I don't know how they do it. I don't.
So what role are you playing when you're up there? Are you helping with the scripts? Are you helping with like, I don't think they're portraying the way I want them to feel. Are you picking out actors? Are you?
So I have several different projects going on right now. The one that releases in August, you know, I didn't write the script. They did get my feedback. They've been very receptive to and have included me along the way, but I'm not going to sit here and say, like, that's my movie. Mm-hmm. They made that. I think they would have made it based on or how they wanted, based on my input or not. I'm extremely happy with it. It exceeded my expectations. I went into it, I think, fearing and expecting the worst. Mm-hmm. And now I'm fearing that it's good. Uh-huh. Like, I'm like, what's going to happen now? You know, like they did a really good job. And Blake Lively, oh my gosh, I just can't even go on about the talent that woman has. But I have other projects that I'm extremely involved in. Like, I've written scripts for a couple of them with a partner of mine, Lauren Levine, and we're starting our own production company. So I don't really want to go into what we're working on first, but mm-hmm. we have a couple that are in the works that will have a hand in everything that happens. But then there's also Verity, which I sell to Amazon, which I don't have as much involvement in, kind of like with It Ends With Us, but you know, it's Amazon. I have faith in them. So I'm excited mm-hmm. about that one.
So how much time are you spending? You're in LA, right? Or Hollywood or?
I do a lot over Zoom. So it hasn't been that hard. Yeah. Okay. So I'm mostly here in Texas.
Okay. So I know you just flew back last night. And so
yeah, I had to be there because we had Sony held a big party for the release of the trailer that's coming up. Mm-hmm. So I was there for that and had a few meetings, but mostly, you know, luckily, I think one good thing that came from the pandemic was that they realized how much you can do over Zoom, and it doesn't require everyone to be on a plane and going right. to all these different places. So, yeah, even my partner and I wrote a script together over Zoom. So it's made things easier.
So you're able to see things that are going on set. Do they have you on one of those robots with like the tractor wheels and you're able to drive it around?
Oh, no.
I'm not just on, your face up here looking?
I'm not on set like that. I did get to go spend a couple weeks when they were filming It Ends With Us in Hoboken. Mm-hmm. But they send me the daily. So like every day they film their footage all day long and then they'll send it to all the producers at night so you can watch what was filmed and what mm-hmm. the scenes look like. And that was really cool.
That's awesome. Excuse me. Is there an author out there? I know you have some really close friends that are authors. Is there an author out there that has inspired you by not only what they've accomplished, but their writing style?
That's twofold, man. So my best friend, Taryn Fisher, and I'm not saying this because she's my best friend, but her writing style is insane. Like mm-hmm. her sentences are art. You know, what I could write, you know, I could sit for 6 hours and write three whole chapters, and she's still on her second sentence because mm-hmm. every sentence is so important to her. Crafted. And so sometimes I'll just open her books to study them. I'm like, how does she do this? Because mm-hmm. I feel like my talent is storytelling. It's not the writing. Like mm-hmm. if I have to look up a word in the thesaurus, I'm not going to use it.
Right.
But Yael James, 50 Shades of Grey, I have been friends with her from the beginning, and the way that she's handled her career, the criticism, the massive success, you know, from, you know, becoming people's punching bag on Saturday Night Live. And I said Saturday Night Live. I don't think she was a punching bag. They just had something about her book on there, but I think it was positive, actually. Mm-hmm. But, you know, you see a lot of negative stuff because, yeah. you know, like I said, people like to make fun or be mean to people that have success that they don't think is deserved. But she has been the most consistent, genuine, generous person or that I know. And so just being able to watch that, I think, has been so helpful in everything that's happened with me. Like, she's just been a great friend and role model to have in my life.
Would you say she's like a mentor? Is that what you're kind of going at?
Absolutely. Or? I'm okay. constantly like, how did you handle this? How do okay. you know, how do you do this? And even in the beginning when I was nobody, she was giving me advice. Mm-hmm. She just gives so much of herself and so much of her time and to other authors and to her readers. Like, she's still every day on Facebook interacting with her readers. And I'm like, girl, you've probably got billions. What are you doing? Aren't you living on a yacht cut off from social media? But yeah. that's just not her. She's yeah. just, and she still comes to the event that I host in Dallas with signing with, you know, all these authors every year. Doesn't have to, doesn't, you know, have a new book she needs to promote or anything, but just wants to support the charity and support mm-hmm. our friendship. And it means so much to me that I know that it's a lot for her because she lives overseas.
Yeah.
So yeah, I always try to keep her in mind whenever I feel like I need to be brought down to earth a little.
Is there an expiration date on your career?
No, there's not. I don't even look at it like that. Like, as long as I feel like writing, I think I will be writing. Mm-hmm. I'm not. I will say I don't feel like I have many goals to reach. Of course, mm-hmm. That was never really the goal. So there's nothing really that I'm like, oh, I need to accomplish this before I retire. I need to do this, or I need to make this much money. I will do this until I'm unhappy. Mm-hmm. Because happiness is the only thing I want.
Yeah. I always tell everybody, like, I do my job and then I go paint at night.
Yeah.
And everybody's like, you're going to burn out. And I'm like, no, like, you don't understand. Like, these are logs on the fire for me. Exactly. You know what I mean? And for people that don't feel that, like, they don't get it. They're like, I need to sit on the couch and watch TV or whatever.
Yeah.
But to me, that's draining, you know, and I need those things to keep me like running all the time. Yeah. Like, I need to stretch this muscle. You know?
Yeah, no, it's exciting. Like, mm-hmm. I have my office downstairs, and on the times that I have this free time to go down there and, you know, set everything up and get ready to like dive into my story, like that to me is what gives me energy and purpose and happiness and, you know, makes me not a miserable person for my husband. Like, he even knows, like, do you need to go write for a little while?
Yeah, I've got to shoot away myself. Yeah. All right, so I'm going to take this in a different direction. You look amazing.
Thank you.
Like, you walked in the door and I was like, man, check out Colleen. She's doing it. Like, I'm super proud for you. Like, I'm genuinely happy, you know? And so I told you about, you know, my wife, you know, doing this shot or whatever. And
yeah.
And the transition in her, and you were like, well, I'm kind of doing the same thing. Do you want to talk about that at all?
Yeah, absolutely, because I feel like people aren't honest enough, and I feel like it gets a bad rap. But it's probably a year and a half ago. I don't know. Like, I don't even remember. It was before it was a thing for weight loss, because I got put on it because my A1C was outrageous. My cholesterol was outrageous. I got diagnosed pre-diabetic. And so I actually got put on it for having pre-diabetes. And I mean, how I just felt like such a failure. I was, think, 40, 41. And I'm like, oh my God, I'm taking more medication than my mother. Like, mm-hmm. this is insane. But I noticed after the first couple of months of taking it that I was losing a few pounds here and there. And I wasn't even thinking about it. Like, I constantly obsessed over food all the time. It's what, like, I eat when I'm bored. I eat when I'm happy. I celebrate everything with food. And so then it got approved for weight loss. And I told everyone I could. I'm like, I'm on this. You need to try it. Mm-hmm. I tell you, I did not even think about it again for about 3 or 4 months. I just got busy, wasn't really paying attention to my weight, and went to the doctor and was down about 30 pounds. And that was the first time I had lost weight in my adult life. Like, I have steadily gained weight since high school. And that's when I was like, holy cow, this is making a difference. You know, and I'm not even thinking about it. Like, I feel like every diet I tried before this made me more obsessed with food and dieting. Mm-hmm. And this just took that away. Maybe after a year of taking it, I had lost 100 pounds.
Wow.
I'm down 110. My A1C is back to normal. My cholesterol is back to normal. And once everything was back to normal at the doctor, I stopped taking it. Also, it's pretty hard to find now, and I didn't like, you know, having to deal with that. Mm-hmm. But so I'm not on it anymore, but it worked for me. You know, I am so appreciative. I truly believe it saved my life. And when I see so many people that don't know how many people are actually taking it for medical reasons, but that, you know, when they complain because, oh, well, you're not pre-diabetic, you shouldn't be taking it. I'm like, yeah, but when you're 100 pounds overweight, that's going to lead to pre-diabetes. Mm-hmm. It's all leading to the same direction. I don't know. I'm happy for your wife that it's working for her. I have friends that it hasn't worked for, but I owe my life to this. Like, I feel good, and I'm still, like, I think I weighed last night, I was like still 200 and something pounds. Like, I'm, you know, near what they say I should be, but I'm very happy. I feel good. My numbers are good, so I'm not really worried about where society thinks women should weigh.
Yeah. And so I just remember, like, we've noticed over, you know, the public or whatever, you see somebody make a drastic change, mm-hmm. and then they come out and say they've done this.
Yeah.
It's very
terrifying.
It's terrifying. Yeah. But it's also very, like, enlightening for, like, my wife. I think about what she says. Well, good for them.
Yeah.
You know, because it's a mental struggle that people feel like they have to justify why they're on or justify what they're doing, or...
Yeah, and you know, it's weird. It's been like that for anything, I believe, that works. You've got your people that hate on low carb. You've got your people that hate on fasting. Like, mm-hmm. you know, nothing anyone says on the internet at this point is celebrated.
Right.
You know? And so don't go trying to find anything positive there. I would say talk to your doctor, talk to a therapist, figure out what makes you happy. It's definitely, I was shocked by how many people had something to say about the weight loss, because I've also seen them have the same stuff to say about the people who have the surgery. And
right.
And I'm like, you know what, to each their own. And if it's making you healthier and you feel like you're going to live longer, mm-hmm. isn't that what we're all striving for?
Yeah. Yeah. It's how many days can you get on this journey, right? Yeah. How many healthy days can you get on this journey, right? I don't know that I'm going to be here tomorrow. I don't know that I'm going to be here in 5 or 10 years. But the longer that it's a race that I'm winning with every day that's accrued. And yeah. if I can get something that makes that race longer for me, great. I would love to do that, right? I started taking the testosterone stuff like a year ago, right? Mm-hmm. I was exhausted. I mean, to be honest, it's probably because I'm working all day and painting all night.
Exactly.
But sleep. I was getting like 4 hours of sleep a night, and that's just how I'm built, right? And so, but I had done other things to my body during that time of not being able to do that. So I started taking testosterone therapy, and I bounced back. And now I'm even sleeping more, right? I'm sleeping 7 hours a night now.
Yeah.
That's weird, right? You would think, oh, he's doing this to try to do it. I'm not crazy in shape. I'm just trying to be happy and healthy and keep things moving in the right direction. And you know, it's kind of balanced me out, to be quite honest, which is just really cool. But there's a mental aspect that goes with it too, right? It's not just how many days of health I have. It's how I feel about myself.
Yeah.
And I think about this when I talk about with my wife or things like that, right? Like, how do you feel about yourself? Are you okay with yourself? Are you okay with what you see in the mirror? Are you okay mm-hmm. with that? That's a hurdle for a lot of people to have to deal with,
right?
You know, as they go through that. And so if this can help you get to the I'm okay with myself stage, man, that's just as important as how many days do I have left,
mm-hmm.
you know? So super happy with that part of it, you know, and you know, making sure that people are taking care of themselves physically and mentally, you know, when it comes to that part of it. So
it's hard to do. We tend to put ourselves last.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'll tell you this. I'm going to close it out with this. We've been talking for a little bit, and it's been one of my favorite conversations I've had in a long time. And we always, every time that you and I have a conversation, it's never shallow. And I love that.
Right.
You know, I feel like I'm talking to someone and I'm getting real words out of it. And it's not just you as me. Sometimes I don't deliver exactly the true feeling to somebody. Sometimes I'm shallow with it. You know, I'm like, I'll say like, how's your day? Oh, best day ever or whatever. You know, it's like you say things that are just programmed to come out.
Yeah.
But with you, for some reason, and I'm sure this is what your entire audience sees, some reason you tear the barriers down for people because you tear the barriers down for yourself. And it's inspirational. I want to say thank you for that. And thank you for taking the time to come talk with me for an hour and 25 minutes.
Well, thank you for having me. I appreciate it. I appreciate the role that you have had in my career and my life. And I wish you the best of luck.
Thank you.
Enjoy this last week with your child before they graduate. Oh my gosh.
It's so sad. I got graduation next week. I got to leave here a little early because we're doing, first off, lunch on the grass, which is going to be nice.
Oh, that's
fun. Like when we were like in kindergarten, we used to go out there. So now they're kind of resetting to do that.
Oh, that's so sweet. Yeah. It's like full circle. Yeah. Aww.
So we're going to do that, which is going to make, you know, mom and dad probably tear up a little bit. But
yep.
But that's good. That's what it's about, right?
Yep.
Taking those memories in. So
that's awesome. Well, congratulations.
Thank you. And congratulations to you too. All the success you've had. Well deserved. You deserve all of it. You are not an imposter.
Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you, everybody.